Hey there, and welcome to Marvel by the Month, the podcast that takes you through the history of Marvel Comics one month at a time. In this episode, that month is August 1970. My name is Brian Stratton.
Mine is Rob Milne.
And I'm Jamie Winger.
Fellas, this week's episode is all about death.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Not as metal as it sounds, too.
No. Yeah. It is a morbid month in the Marvel Universe. So good thing everything in the world is totally cool and chipper. And, you know, we have nothing but good times. We can handle a month like this.
Yeah, we can bring everybody down.
Sure,
Nobody's got any other mental issues right now.
Hey, I have a death question right away.
Sure.
Is this the death made of bones with the robe, but also sort of a shapely womanly figure somehow also, despite being made of bones?
No, because Jim Starlin hasn't shown up yet.
Oh, that's going to be a good day.
Yeah, it is going to be a great day.
But this is not that day.
It's way too much flesh on that death for me.
Hey, real deaths have curves. So we're going to be taking a deep dive into three issues this episode that all deal with issues of mortality. We are going to be talking about When Dies a Legend from Avengers number 81, A Life on the Line from Daredevil number 69, and Death Shall Come from Amazing Spider-Man number 90. And at least in one of these stories, that is not an exaggeration.
It's true.
We are going to lose a major Marvel character this month. So, like Ben Grimm would say, get your crying towels handy. Was a crying towel a thing that people actually had? Like, I mean, was that like, did you have a specific article of linen in case you needed?
Like one of the arsenal of handkerchiefs.
right. Yeah. Around your belt.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they had fainting couches, so that doesn't seem like a stretch then to have.
Sure.
Yeah.
Fainting couch and crying towel seems like a buddy cop situation. Like
that's a rough room in your house, though.
Yeah. I could use both of those, I think, now.
Yeah. So before we proceed, gentlemen, do you feel like we are emotionally prepared for this?
Oh, hell no.
I mean, always no.
Yeah. No, me neither.
We're going to just be wrecks.
Yeah.
I seriously had water in my eyes as I finished one of these.
Yeah.
Books.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was no issue of not Brand X this month, so that's not what it was.
Yeah, a change.
Yeah. here's some happy news. This is episode number 147, which means episode number 150 is, if I've done the math correctly, 3 weeks away. Do we have a plan for that? Yes.
Yay.
Kind of.
Yay.
Here's what's going to happen. I'm going to say a bunch of stuff here, and then I'm going to edit out what winds up not being true. We are going to be doing our second ever live show on Wednesday, March 30th. That is like 1 week away from when this episode drops. So that's why we're talking about it without having a fully baked plan.
Wow. That is soon and exciting.
Yeah. So look, there are a lot of moving parts here. So please do not listen to this episode for the most up to the minute details. Check our Instagram, which is at Marvel by the Month, and Twitter, which is at Marvel BTM, for the most up to date info. We are recording this 3 weeks out from the show. And if the last 2 years have taught us anything, it is not to make plans 3 weeks out.
Yeah, seriously.
Our extra special guest for the episode will be our good buddy and New York Times bestselling author, Chelsea Kane.
Yeah. Whoa. So I don't know if you guys have noticed the pictures of face masks that I've been sending. I'm getting my skin all nice and dewy and youthful.
Oh, yeah.
Starting doing push-ups. I'm very excited. I'm sweating in advance of that. I will be super nervous.
I'm sure she appreciates all of that.
I can't wait to see your clammy self.
Yeah, it's going to get real
scare
gross.
Scare the crap out of Chelsea. Yeah.
I mean, obviously, we're going to seat him right next to Chelsea.
Yeah.
Like, that's how this is going to go.
Oh, the amount of deodorant. I'm not even going to be able to, like, put my arms down. I'm just going to be rushing.
You're going to look like a guy who had been in a skiing accident.
Yeah, like more than usual.
Yeah, one of the issues that we're going to be talking about is Avengers number 83, which is just a full-on feminist panic fever dream. And, you know, Chelsea, she has a very particular set of skills. Skills she has acquired over a very long career of dealing with dudes on the internet. Skills that make her a nightmare for issues like that. So it should be a hoot and a holler. Yeah. Check our Instagram, check our Twitter. Wednesday, March 30th, live show, Chelsea Kane, We'll see how much of all of that winds up being true.
Right. Some percentage, probably.
The Oracle.
So that is the near future. But let us return to the distant past. And before we talk about the Marvel Comics of August 1970, we got to take a look at some of what was happening in the world of August 1970. Rob, why don't you kick us off with a little bit of historical context?
Sure. August 1st, 1970, the first three-day San Diego Comic-Con, then known as the Golden State Comic-Con, was held at the U.S. Grant Hotel from August 1st through 3rd. Guests of honor included Ray Bradbury and Jack Kirby.
Whoa. I've heard of those guys.
Yeah.
On August 2nd, 1970, filmmaker, comic shop proprietor, and Daredevil writer Kevin Smith was born in Red Bank, New Jersey.
Nice.
He made the movie that was the most uncomfortable to watch with your parents, which would be Clerks.
I was going to say, I mean,
like which one?
Yeah,
it's yeah. I watched Clerks with my parents.
I watched The Hangover 2 with my parents, and I think Clerks would be better.
yeah, for sure.
On August 7th, 1970, in San Rafael, California, Harold Haley, a Superior Court judge from Marin County, was taken hostage during the criminal trial of a member of the Black Panthers, James D. McClane. Whoa. Jonathan P. Jackson had smuggled a pistol and a carbine rifle into the courtroom, then tossed the weapon to McClane, who then pressed the rifle against Judge Haley's neck in order to guarantee that the weapon would discharge if anyone attempted to stop the escape.
Whoa.
Taking Assistant Prosecutor Gary Thomas and three women jurors as additional hostages, McClane, Jackson, and convict witnesses William Christmas and Rochelle McGee climbed into a rented van, and Jackson began to drive to the parking lot exit, where they were met by a blockade of 100 law enforcement officers. McClane then killed Judge Haley before dying in, I mean, what was the inevitable shootout.
Yeah.
Which also killed Jackson and Christmas.
Whoa.
Wow.
Yeah.
Whew. Okay. On the 10th of August, a proposed Equal Rights Amendment to the U.S. Constitution was overwhelmingly approved in the House of Representatives by a vote of 350-15.
Wow.
After having been introduced every year since 1923.
Oh, gosh.
Although a similar measure would be approved in the U.S. Senate, the session of the 91st United States Congress would expire 5 months later before the two houses of Congress could agree on a form to be submitted to the 50 states for ratification.
I don't know the story behind that. I didn't have a chance to dig in deeper, but I mean, that's suspicious, right?
Yeah. What I know of politics between that wing,
yeah.
of our government, I'm like, yeah, it's probably just sort of give us a star, even though we know this isn't going to happen.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's like, it seems like a really, you know, a what do they call it? A pocket veto, when like you shoot down legislation without actually voting it down. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Mm.
Gross.
Yep.
On August 10th, 1970, the 232 prisoners housed on the ninth floor of the overcrowded Manhattan House of Detention, colloquially known as the Tombs, took five guards hostage at daybreak and demanded reforms and meetings with Mayor John V. Lindsay. At the time, the facility had a maximum capacity of 932 men for its small cells and had almost 3,000 detainees in filthy conditions, many of whom had been awaiting a court date for months. The prisoners released their hostages unharmed after a pledge from the city that would not be prosecuted for the takeover, and the overcrowding would be eased by the transfer of inmates to other prisons in the state.
Well, that one ended better.
Yeah.
On the 11th of August, at the predominantly Roman Catholic village of Crossmaglen in Protestant County Armagh, two police officers of the Royal Ulster Constabulary became the first victims of the Irish Republican Army's announced campaign to target UK law enforcement officers in Northern Ireland.
Huh.
Constables Bob Miller, 26, and Sam Donaldson, age 23, were fatally injured when they stopped to investigate a small Ford Cortina automobile that had been abandoned on Crossmaglen's Lissaraw Road. When one of them lifted the hood of the car, 15 pounds of gelignite detonated. Miller and Donaldson both died the next day. In all, 301 members of the RUC would be killed until the campaign ceased in 1998.
Whoa.
Man. There's a good amount of death in history to support our death in fiction.
Yeah,
for sure.
On the 11th of August, 1970, former heavyweight boxing champion Muhammad Ali was granted a license to box for the first time since being stripped of his title in 1967. At the time, Ali's conviction for draft evasion was still on appeal and awaiting a hearing before the U.S. Supreme Court. Wow. Although then heavyweight champion Joe Frazier declined to appear, Ali's return to boxing would take place as scheduled against popular heavyweight Jerry Quarry.
Jerry Quarry is a great name for a boxer.
It really is. On August 12th, 1970, singer Janis Joplin gave what would prove to be her final concert, appearing before 35,000 people at the Harvard University Stadium.
Mm-hmm. On the 22nd of August, 1970, North Korea rejected a proposal from South Korea's President Park Chung-hee to discuss reunification of the two nations. The statement came in a lengthy editorial in the North Korean Communist Party's official newspaper, Rodong Sinmun, and declared that the 64,000 U.S. troops in South Korea would have to be withdrawn before any negotiations could begin. North Korea also described President Park as, quote, a faithful running dog of U.S. imperialist aggressors, ooh, which is very on brand for North Korea.
Yes, seriously.
On the 23rd of August, 1970, members of the United Farm Workers in California voted to begin the largest strike of farm workers in U.S. history. The walkout came less than a month after UFW leader Cesar Chavez had signed a contract with the major farm employers to permit a union, then found that the Teamsters were allowed to compete against the UFW in organizing workers. The walkout would last for 7 months, finally ending on March 26th when the UFW and the Teamsters were able to reach an agreement granting the UFW jurisdiction over field workers.
Hmm. Interesting. On August 24th, 1970, one person was killed and four others were injured by a terrorist bomb detonated outside of Sterling Hall on the campus of the University of Wisconsin in Madison. The four-story building, which was used by UV Madison Physics Department and the U.S. Army Mathematics Research Center, was the target of a group that called itself the New Year's Gang. The group stole a van and placed a cargo of 2,000 pounds of ammonium nitrate and fuel oil explosives inside, then parked in front of Sterling Hall at about 3 in the morning and set a timer. At 3:37 a.m., one of the plotters called the Madison Police Department and warned them that a bomb was in the center and would go off in 5 minutes. The city police called the university police 1 minute later. The bomb exploded at 3:42. Robert Fasnacht, a 33-year-old physicist, was working late in the building when the bomb exploded and was killed instantly. Three of the four bombers would be arrested between 1972 and 1977 and would serve a few years in prison before being released, while the fourth, Leo Burt, was never located despite having been on the FBI 10 Most Wanted Fugitives for more than 5 years.
Wow. Yeah.
That's crazy. That's a crazy story.
It is. There's so much kind of wild stuff happening, and I feel like every time we get to August in any of the years we cover, I feel like that's...
There's a spike.
Yeah. I feel like summers are real bad for this stuff.
I don't want to think about this coming August then.
Yeah, since everything's so aimed at success
stable
right now.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. That's why I'm planning on just living in a hole in the ground for all of August this year.
Okay.
We're just going to go into reruns.
Yeah.
Yep.
Or build a Batcave studio.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. Perfect. The acoustics, can you imagine? On the 25th of August, Jack Kirby's first DC comic since leaving Marvel hit the stands.
Whoa.
Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen, number 133, featured the debuts of the New Generation Newsboy Legion, Intergang, and Morgan Edge.
Cool.
And inevitably inspired, or would inspire, a young Matt Fraction.
Aww. Yeah.
On the 26th of August, the Women's Strike for Equality took place on Fifth Avenue in New York City, with an estimated 25,000 marchers demonstrating in favor of equal pay for equal jobs.
Yeah.
Leading the parade was a car carrying several elderly women who fought for female suffrage 50 years earlier and was timed to coincide with the anniversary of the August 26, 1920, adoption of the 19th Amendment to the United States Constitution that granted women the right to vote nationwide. Similar events took place with 5,000 marchers in Boston and 3,000 in Chicago.
Wow. And when people come together, representative and, mm-hmm. and take steps. That's very good.
It is helpful. It is good.
Yeah.
It's always sad that that's what's necessary.
Yeah, right? On August 29th, 1970, the Chicano moratorium against the Vietnam War began in East Los Angeles. A parade through the streets quickly became violent, and 3 days of rioting followed. Journalist Ruben Salazar, a columnist for the LA Times and news director for the KMEX TV station, was found dead inside a cafe, the victim of a, quote, high-velocity tear gas shell that had been fired into the Silver Dollar Cafe by a Los Angeles County Sheriff's deputy.
And finally, August wrapped up on the 30th with the third and last annual Isle of Wight Festival, which featured 3 days of rock, pop, and jazz performances before a crowd that reached 250,000 people.
Whoa.
Most of whom were able to get in without paying or who watched from a hillside.
It was the last one, huh?
It was headlined by Joan Baez. The list of stars included Jimi Hendrix in one of his very last appearances, The Who, Joni Mitchell, The Doors, Emerson, Lake and Palmer, The Moody Blues, Chicago, Jethro Tull, Miles Davis, Tiny Tim, and Leonard Cohen.
Sick.
The festival took place near Freshwater on Britain's Isle of Wight, and it was marked by drug arrests, minor riots, and massive financial losses for the producers. So there's the original Fire Festival.
Yeah.
Except they actually managed to, you know, put on a show. So, anyway, that's what was going on in this wild month of August 1970. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we are going to talk about the Marvel Comics of August 1970 right here on Marvel by the Month. Hey, everyone. As we mentioned last episode, Marvel by the Month has started accepting sponsors this season. And we are so grateful to this week's sponsor. Rob, please tell us a little bit about them.
Our sponsor this week is Wallace Brown Cards. Look, everyone you know needs Christmas cards, and everyone loves Wallace Brown Cards. Do you know 10 people? Of course you do. Add up several neighbors, some relatives, the grocer, the milkman, your dentist, a few friends, and you've got a lot more. These folks alone can bring you in at least $50, probably $100 and more. In just a few hours spare time.
And this is just a start. Most everyone uses Christmas and all occasion cards. And when you show them the thrilling new Wallace Brown line of greeting cards and gift items, it's love at first sight. They'll snap up 2, 3, 6 or more box assortments and other things too. It's a fun way of making money because it's so easy.
If you need extra money and you know just 10 people, you can make $50, $100, $200 and more in your spare time. Simply cut out the entire business reply envelope below. Fill in the coupon envelope, fold over firmly, seal with paste or tape, and mail today. No stamp necessary. It costs you nothing to try. So thank you to Wallace Brown Cards. We are also supported each and every month by our patrons who subscribe at patreon.com/marvelbythemonth. Even though we have started accepting sponsorships from great partners like Wallace Brown Cards, our Patreon supporters are the ones who really make it possible for us to continue making Marvel by the Month.
And everyone who supports us at the $4 a month level gets access to the Marvel by the Month bonus feed. There'll be extended versions of each and every episode that we release this season on that bonus feed, including this one. If you want to hear all three of our deep dives this week, you got to get on that Patreon.
And 24 of the episodes that we recorded last season have expanded versions on that feed as well, not to mention Patreon-exclusive bonus episodes. So if you want to hear more of our conversations with Mark Evanier, Chelsea Kane, Matt Fraction, Mike Allred, Elliot Kalin, Tom Brevoort, Douglas Wolk, Joe Keating, and so many others, head over to patreon.com/marvelbythemonth and subscribe today.
Your support makes it possible for us to afford the time and stuff we need to continue making this show. By stuff, I mean beer. So thank you so much to those of you who support us already, and thank you to those of you who are heading over to patreon.com/marvelbythemonth to support us right now!
Wow. Welcome back to Marvel by the Month. We will be kicking it off with Avengers 81, When Dies a Legend, written by Roy Thomas, art by John Buscema and Tom Palmer. If the cover is to be believed, inside we'll find a scene where Vision lifts an unconscious and dripping Wanda out of a huge puddle, or possibly a tiny lake, while surrounded by mobsters, mobster types with guns and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to probably Tarantino the situation and see what's going on. There's an opening splash page that looked to me like it's like 15 or 20 years ahead of its time. It looks super modern. I couldn't really put my finger on why exactly, because Iron Man's face still looks kind of old, but maybe it's the inking. I don't know.
Yeah,
it's
maybe.
It's like a really nice looking page.
Mm-hmm. It is a good splash. It establishes all the characters we're not going to see in this issue.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So it's like, hope you weren't excited to see Captain America, Iron Man, Quicksilver, Thor, or Black Panther.
Right.
Because they ain't in this
one. You get to see them for a couple pages while they talk about why they're not going to be here.
Yeah. And then they say they'll be right back. They're going out for smokes.
Yeah. So Cap, Quicksilver, Thor, Black Panther, and Iron Man are all lamenting the beginning of the end of the Avengers because Vision, Goliath, and Scarlet Witch are kind of doing their own thing for the day or whatever.
I have a whole thing here.
Okay. I got a whole thing.
Go for it, because once you do your thing, I got a thing.
All right. Let's do it. We'll derail this right away. So to me, this is like the difference between like old and silly comics and modern comics. And I mean modern in any era that you're in. So like, I can believe that a guy can essentially give himself unlimited superpowers wearing a metal suit that he made by himself in a cave. Like, that's not a problem. Sure. I can totally do that. Maybe quibble about like, does it work underwater or not? Because there's like rules, right? Like each one of these things have rules. And as long as they follow those rules, it's fine.
Sure.
Right. What I can't get past is when you're telling me a situation is a huge organizing, destroying problem, when the situation is like not even a problem for like a child, like a small child could reason their way out of this like social thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they like can't get past it. And it's like, that's not how real people act. It's not how super people act.
Yeah.
Especially super people who already have and follow the parliamentary procedures that they do.
Right.
Like, yeah. They can put things to votes. Yeah. They can solve this really easily. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, are they so sensitive and thin skinned that they just can't deal with the fact that they've had a respectful disagreement about what their priorities should be? And they're like, you know what? We're just going to have to agree to disagree. How about we go deal with this thing, you deal with that thing, and then we'll all get back together at the end of it.
Yeah, I'll catch you on Monday. Like, it'll be fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's just like, any comic that dates itself by that sort of thing, like, is going to sound bad.
Yeah. And it's like, I know what this is like. So they, like, Roy has it all set up so that the story that follows this is a big Zodiac story.
Sure.
Fine. You know, like, and he didn't want to write 9 characters, so I mean already the plot's a little thin, because you know we've got 4 or 5 superheroes who are going after a corrupt real estate developer.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have 9 superheroes go after a corrupt real estate developer.
Yeah,
right.
Sure.
You know, so I understand you gotta split the party.
I mean, yeah, but this real estate developer has some means.
He does, like, indeed have some
he
means.
Seems to suddenly have like Tony Stark levels of means,
right?
Like Bruce Wayne levels
but
of
they've
means.
They've got Tony Stark.
Yeah, I know.
And then another 8 guys
and a god of thunder.
And you know what often makes a story work? Cutting between 2 different things. Like, it's like, this is
wait, what?
Yeah, I know, this is a crazy idea.
Or just say it's like, you know what, we're gonna go deal with this, you deal with that. And then just not try to convince us that this is some apocalyptic,
problem.
You know, situation.
This is what we've become. It's season 7, and now we
are all
get off my lawn.
Pedantically ripping apart the storytelling problems of Roy Thomas. But yeah,
but it's like, it's
true.
Not, like, it's not pedantic in the way that like, oh, his powers could never work like that. Like,
right.
it's not unrealistic fiction. It's unrealistic people.
Right.
And that is like a deal breaker for me.
He deflated all of the characters by making them solve this problem in such a poor way.
I'll take it one step further. If they actually do have, if this is a big problem for them, it's like the Marvel Universe has bigger problems than they think it does.
So anyway, Captain America hopes that if this is the end of the Avengers, he hopes something even more noble will take its place, which that was a nice moment. It's on brand for him.
Sure.
Black Panther again name drops that he's a teacher, which I started mentioning as kind of a joke initially, but it's like, it's pretty egregious at this point.
And Quicksilver is like calls him on it. Like, we're not likely to forget that, T'Challa, since you say it every 5 seconds.
Yeah. It's pretty ridiculous. So after saying that, Black Panther peels off from the group to save children or whatever he's up to in Daredevil. And then that just leaves Thor, Iron Man, Quicksilver, and Cap to deal with Zodiac or whatever this comic was about before it became about this conversation. So now we're kind of done with these Jokers for now. Up in the Quinjet, Red Wolf is feeling like he and his Wolf Lobo should have gone it alone, because that would prove that he's worthy of the title. But he also maybe just wants to get away from Vision, and because he's creepy and weird. Like,
yeah, and also, like, Goliath is still not shrunk down, even though he's inside of a jet, a cramped jet with, you know, four other people.
Yeah,
nothing, or, like, sorry, three people and a wolf. I assume the wolves are not people. But, sure, you know, sure. Yeah.
I'm not sure about the physics, but his mass seems to increase.
Yeah.
With his size. So that's just bad fuel efficiency, for one, you know.
Right.
Do you think that Vision is compensating by making himself like slightly intangible?
Oh my god, I love that. That's awesome.
I want to know about the mass and density of these two characters and stat.
Yeah, well, you know what's definitely also large is his armpits. Definitely have not, they're not small, and no, they're in a tight space.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And that costume is,
and he doesn't wear a shirt.
Yeah, exactly.
He wears like suspenders with a shoulder thing. I don't know what he's doing.
We get some inner monologue from all four of the characters on there. Clint is admiring Red Wolf's nobility, I think. And both Wanda and Vision are kind of questioning their own decisions here, which, I don't know, maybe is a cool way of showing that their characters are aligning a little bit. An argument could be made there. Mm-hmm. So anyway, they're off to deal with the Red Wolf situation when they're hit with an explosion from a purple ship up in space.
Yep.
Sure.
Yeah.
Normal.
Sure. The Quinjet is unarmed, which was surprising to me and seems short-sighted given everything. And then Goliath wastes no time telling Wanda that this is no place for a chick, even one with hex powers. And while he's being sexist, Vision phases into space.
while he's being sexist, Vision actually solves the problem.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, wow, if you guys were in competition, it's over.
Yeah.
It looks cool here. We haven't really talked about the art. Vision phasing into space and getting onto the other ship, which is piloted by like a cool looking robot. We get some Kirby crackles.
Mm-hmm.
There's some nice art here.
Yeah.
Seeing Vision do this kind of stuff and not just like phase out of a skin suit is awesome. This is why my brother and I were obsessed with Vision as like one of the most powered characters when we were growing up.
Yeah. You know, this is a group of people without a clear leader. And I guess it's Vision.
Yeah, by default, kind of, because he's the grown-up.
Right, right. Yeah, Hawkeye's definitely the child.
Yeah. I've also noticed that, I love John Buscema's art, especially Tom Palmer, you know, inking him. I've noticed a trend where he is kind of getting a little bit more conservative with his panel layouts and structure. Whereas, do you remember when he did that issue of Silver Surfer that was in Asgard? It was just so over the top with, you know, just these grand vistas and like people, you know, in different panel layouts and page structures and things like that. I learned recently, apparently Stan Lee had he dressed him down for that.
No way. Oh.
Yeah.
Why?
I told him, it's like, that's not how we do things around here, basically.
Oh. So it's getting back to staid Kirby six panel layouts.
Yeah. Which I mean, it's still great.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong.
Sure. Sure.
But it's like, I am missing a little bit of that, you know, Big John bigness.
Yeah.
That we were seeing earlier.
Oh, yeah. It is mostly
changing
six
panels. I mean, Ditko started that. Mm-hmm. I mean, and of course, Steranko expanded on it.
Yeah. And Neil Adams.
And Neil Adams went crazy good with it. And of course, this, it's just sad to see it get back to rectilinear, you know, same.
Yeah.
I wonder if that was like, Kirby's gone and he's scared, like,
yeah, Stan's like, everything's got to be more like Kirby, we don't have Kirby.
Yeah,
which it looks like there's a lot of like these Kirby crackles, there's a lot of things that robots, things that come up that look very
the
Kirby.
Machinery all the gear is for sure. So the deal with the space robot flying the purple ship is he's under the orders of Van Lunt, the mobster who had like a triple cross against the Avengers a couple issues back to get them to work in a quarry, I think.
And a terrible mustache.
It was a real weird thing, but this guy's back, so that's kind of cool. Vision kind of destroys this whole situation and then wonders how Van Lunt got the money and tech, and also wonders if his friends are alive. Yeah. In that order.
Well, he's a robot.
He's a robot, right? Yeah. He sees Wanda in some water and fishes her out, and then the mobsters recreate the front cover, which feels satisfying. It's really nice.
On page 8, too. Yeah. We didn't have to wait until the very end, which is the thing that Tom Brevoort hated as a kid. You know? It's like the cover would tell you what happened on page 19, and then you'd have to buy the next month's issue.
Yeah. It's a nice moment.
Yep.
Vision and Wanda are too weak to fight off the mobsters who are surrounding them, so they agree to go with the mobsters and are brought to Van Lunt's villa. He seems like he has an entire villa.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
He says...
Well, he's a corrupt real estate developer.
Oh, right. So, yeah. If anyone's going to have a villa, it's going to be a corrupt real estate guy. That tracks. So he mentions that the robot craft was a gift from someone that they may meet later.
Also, is he smoking a cigar with a... like a cigarette?
Yeah, like a cigar you'd buy at 7-Eleven.
It looks like it's got the
plastic tip.
Is he smoking a blunt?
But it's probably his own like silver, you know, special thing, because he's wearing like a smoking jacket and a big old cravat.
I guess it's a way to make a guy smoking a cigar seem fancier,
even more. But it just seems pompous.
Silly.
Maybe it's like a new money thing. It's like this guy, he's got all the money in the world, but you can't buy class.
Right.
Ultimately, Van Lunt is using his goons as leverage against Vision, so Vision has to do whatever he wants. Meanwhile, now we cut over to the A story. So you see there's an A story and a B story. Everyone keeping up with this crazy idea?
What about a C story?
Oh, no, my gosh. You could live at this speed.
Well, they're over a C.
Oh, nice. So Goliath and Red Wing are teamed up, and they're kind of bonding.
Red Wolf.
Red Wolf. Oh, my gosh. I'm back
Red
to the
Raven.
Red Robin. Red Robin. Red Robin. Oh, no. I was set up.
Somebody's called Red, it's over.
Big Red.
Oh, man. So they're teamed up. They're bonding. There's a nearby dam that was made by Van Lunt. Right. This is a little bit interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So when they're crashing from the spaceship, it's only a little bit interesting. When they're crashing from the spaceship, they only don't die because they land in a lake.
Right.
The lake was formed by a dam that Van Lunt put up.
Right.
Van Lunt is bad.
Right.
What he's doing to the land is bad, but it also coincidentally saved the Avengers.
It saved his enemies.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
But they could have landed in a puddle like
Wanda.
Like Wanda. You know.
I also want to point out they threw Wanda out of the ship.
Oh my
so
gosh.
She would land somewhere else.
Oh gosh. Fellas.
And when they show her, when you first see her, she's like face down with like limbs akimbo.
Yeah.
It looks like she's toast.
Yes.
Yeah. Like she tried to swim to the shore and didn't quite make it, basically. Yeah.
So they head to a local native village and they ask, they say that they're there to fight against the man who stole their land and dammed the river.
Mm-hmm.
They're a little skeptical of Red Wolf being the real Red Wolf, but then they get ambushed by Van Lunt's people, and so there's a big fight, which kind of proves that he's the guy.
Yes.
And they all band together during this process to fight the bad guys. So the good guys go off to fight Van Lunt in his villa, but Van Lunt sees them coming, so he sends Vision out to tell them to leave, but that he can't explain why. So Goliath...
Clint.
Clint just gets increasingly angry and they end up coming to blows and have a kind of a brief looking fight. Goliath punches Vision and probably shatters his hand because Vision increases his density.
It's satisfying to think so.
It really is.
Yeah.
It was a really nice moment. So they have their big fight. And then meanwhile, Van Lunt sees he uses a racial slur you don't see too often.
Yeah, it's one that I believe Microsoft Word suggested as a synonym for Native American.
Whoa.
Like as recently as like maybe 12 years ago.
Whoa.
So,
yeah. Yikes.
Yep.
I mean,
without infernal as a preface, though.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
That would make a difference. He's the bad guy. So if someone's going to use a racial slur, I guess that's the way to go. But still.
Yeah.
Not good. Oh, so the Van Lunt and people escape with Wanda up into a helicopter.
A helicopter that rises up out of like a hidden, like there's like doors that open in his palatial estate, and the helicopter rises. Like, he couldn't just have a helipad.
This is like how the Blackbird comes out of the basketball court.
Yeah, exactly. Totally. Exactly. Yeah. That's how you know that he's a fancy man.
I mean, the spaceship, I thought, was the first cue.
Yeah.
It seems so much above his pay grade from his first
appearance. Well, we're going to find out.
Yeah, it's a real escalation. I don't even have a guess, actually. I have no idea. So from the helicopter, the bad guys are shooting at the good guys to mow them down while Wanda frees herself and uses her hex powers to save Red Wolf just as he's given up hope. The bad guy's copter explodes and cracks the dam. Lobo and Red Wolf attack the bad guys while Wanda runs off to warn the Avengers as the dam breaks and the rocks fall. It looks like Red Wolf is kind of done for. Vision finds only the mask and returns it to the tribe. But then Red Wolf comes out of disguise as his human alter ego, Will, whose name is Will Talltrees. I don't think we've mentioned that this whole time.
Yeah.
And he's greeted by his uncle, which was the head of the tribe. And they kind of walk off into the sunset discussing how there's work to be done and reclaiming the land.
Yep. And his uncle recognizes him immediately.
Right, like
He knows that. Yeah.
Thank
so he knows he was Red Wolf. He knows that he's okay. And they're off to a, you know, to plan a better future for their people.
Yep.
So,
and a spinoff comic? No.
Well, next we're going to find out. We are promised at the very end of this, we're going to hear the secret of Cornelius Van Lunt. So
compelling. I want to know.
I'm waiting on, I don't know, the middle of my seat.
Right. Yeah, not edgeworthy exactly.
Like, I mean, I'm still sitting. I haven't gotten up and left.
I'm not leaning forward yet.
Right.
But,
right.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Yep. Anyway, that was an issue of Avengers.
Sure was.
That happened to your ears, dear listeners.
Yeah.
All right. Should we take a break?
Yeah, let's take a breather.
All right. We'll be right back here on Marvel by the Month.
Welcome back to Marvel by the Month. Let's talk about Amazing Spider-Man number 90. The title's called And Death Shall Come. This is written by Stan Lee, art by Gil Kane and John Romita. This comic could be 4 pages long, but they are a great and heartbreaking 4 pages.
Yeah.
But we're going to need to cover, you know, the rest of the issue before that. For want of a better word, cliffhanger picks up with Spidey being thrown from a building by Doc Ock.
Nice.
What we didn't know last issue that would have made it an actual cliffhanger is Spidey is out of web fluid.
Yeah.
I like that they mentioned that
Right?
As he's falling in this issue, where last issue we're like, yeah, he's going to probably, you know, thwip and he's fine.
I think I made a joke about it.
He falls off of buildings all the time.
Right. That's how he gets around.
It's his job and mode of transportation.
Yeah. But since he's out of web fluid, there's no web net, web parachute, or general web slinging to save him. So Spidey thinks fast and grabs Ock's arms to use to swing into a window. He ends up climbing in some ducts to escape the extra smart arms and then throws a tracer on them just as they give up on groping for him.
The panel of him crashing into the building, like that page, page 2.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
He's in so many different positions quickly. Like, it really is a fun sense of like movement and like velocity.
Yeah, and just like flailing.
Yeah. Yeah. And then when he's in the whatchamacallit, the tube for the
duct.
The duct, thank you. It's so claustrophobic and like you kind of feel the arms coming.
Yeah.
This issue does a great job of the arms constantly entering the panels from the sides.
Yep.
And it just feels like they could be anywhere and like coming at you. And yeah,
I feel like Gil Kane is the most Ditko we've seen since Ditko.
Very much so.
I'd agree with that.
Yep. And also like that pages 2 and 3, which are just Spidey running from the arms. I mean, you don't see Doc Ock at all.
No.
It's really creepy.
It's a very horror movie move.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now that the tentacles are gone, Spidey escapes and does an alley change back into his Pete clothes. But he is really roughed up and he's weakly heading home. He's just like wobbling. Someone sneaks up behind him without triggering the Spidey sense, and we find out it's Captain Stacy.
That again was like kind of horror tropey. Like, because you see the view from the sidewalk. It's like a shadowy foot.
Yeah, and then the looking over the shoulder.
And then the hand grabs from behind. Yeah. Was like,
Pete, of course, gets flustered, and he's exhausted. Stacy asks him if he's still recovering from the flu, which gives him a lucky out for being in such a bad condition.
Kind of hands in that line.
Yeah.
Because there's also like cops right behind him.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then Pete, which is great because Pete passes out on the street right after that. Like Captain Stacy has to
catch and carry him.
He wakes up to Gwen looking at him.
A very paternal, very paternal move.
Yeah. And also an inversion of what's to come.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Stacy remarks on Peter's amazing powers of recuperation when he's in the bed at the Stacy residence. Pete gets well fast, of course, and then leaves while musing about how Captain Stacy has not ever accused him of being Spider-Man, even though he seems to know more than he lets on. After a brief reminder that Pete wiggled out of an air pollution rally, we get a science montage.
Again, single panel montage. We've seen this a couple issues in a row now with Gil Kane, where like this is, and again, I feel this is a Ditko-y thing to do.
Yeah,
showing those like multiple overlapping images,
the same character in the same frame, but like sort of colored differently to show the passage of time.
Yeah, it's a real rule breaking thing to do.
Yeah.
That's not how this is supposed to work.
Also, Ditko-y is extreme hand things. Like that is a Ditko thing, and Gil Kane picks up on that.
Oh,
a lot
interesting.
Too. Yeah, but like there's very expressive hand gestures.
Yeah.
Hey, do you think Peter Parker is the most shirtless superhero at this point?
I mean, after Goliath.
Yeah, maybe. Clint.
Yeah, right. He obviously takes first because he's
And Red Wolf is coming on strong, but
right out of the gate.
He's retired now.
Yeah, so, true.
Yeah. I couldn't think of another superhero who was as shirtless as Peter Parker.
Kazar. I mean,
Right.
Kazar is full on shirtless.
Yeah.
Even when he's wearing like khakis, he's shirtless.
He doesn't have his own title though. All right. So I'll narrow the scope.
Well, give it some time.
Yeah. Let's,
Silver Surfer doesn't have his own book anymore. So,
but he doesn't have like nipples or things.
Right. Yeah, right.
He's got
no bits.
He's got space trunks.
Okay. So anyway, Pete, science montage. Pete starts cooking up some gadget-based way with a button on a hidden belt to win round two, or three if you count the round where he just fought the arms by themselves. So now Spidey goes out on the prowl for his tracer, and as we learn 82 and a half minutes later, he zeroes in on it. I love to think of that hour in 22 minutes of Peter Parker, or just Spider-Man, this is what it is. Like, he's like, man, I'm looking everywhere. And again, we get a lot of sort of montage scene or just like clips of him in different places, you know, swinging over buildings. So it's good to show that passage of time.
It's like being a cop.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, 2 minutes of action and 90 minutes of paperwork.
Yeah. Right.
And
there was a brief Ned cameo. Spider-Man walked by him while he was sleeping.
Harry.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. It was just like, oh, he's still in this book.
Does he have his mustache is gone?
His mustache is still gone.
Yep.
Hair is still
I'm
weird.
Just scared. I mean, with all of the horror elements of this comic, I'm worried that mustache is going to creep into a panel on its own. That should be a villain. Just
the mustache.
Harry's mustache.
Could be a symbiote.
We gotta get through this. I feel like I'm just like avoiding it. So he zeroes in on the tracker, but Doc Ock was wise to the tracker and attacks Spidey from the roof as Spidey's looking into an empty room.
Like a smart scientist bad guy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's like, I know what a tracker is, dummy. Yeah,
right.
I'm superior.
So fighting ensues. And Gil Kane proves again that he's good at staging action. Mm-hmm. So these fights are, again, like Ditko or Romita, they're enjoyable, even if it's like there's often where we hit like the four pages of fighting or something where you're like, okay, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
And
this is not that.
Like, I'm just looking at this fight now. Like, so page 14, page 15, two solid pages of fighting. The arms are in every panel. And you only see Doc Ock in the background of one of them.
Oh,
like,
yeah. Cool.
The arms are doing all the work.
Yeah. And the camera is everywhere.
The camera's everywhere. And then, but when Spidey finally turns the tide, that's when Doc Ock starts showing up in the panels in page 16.
Cool.
So it's like Spidey has to get the arms of the enemy. Like,
Yeah, right.
It's really cleverly done. It's
very well done.
Yeah.
And in this fight, Spidey manages to get free long enough to finally hit the belt button and shoot two special shots from his web shooters onto two of Doc's tentacles. And surprise, Better Living Through Chemistry has allowed Pete to apply a chemical fluid that jams the ability for Doc to control those arms with his mind. So the arms start attacking the other arms and Doc and whatever. Now they're just crazy arms.
And what's wild is it doesn't just disable them, but it's like they have a mind of their own.
Yeah. So it's creepy. Yeah. That's creepy. Again, and scary. Creepy.
Yeah. With them searching for him in the ducts, they were sort of alluding to that. Like these arms.
Yeah.
Like they somehow can sense things beyond what Doc Ock should be able to sense.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
I also like that it's like if Spider-Man's our puberty kind of metaphor guy and like his body turned on him and made him a hero. And now Doc Ock's body as an adult man is turning on him. And like, that's even more horrible than because you're not expecting it.
So now we are four pages from the end, true believers. These are the four pages I was talking about.
This has been a complete comic at this point.
Like, yeah.
I'm satisfied. I got my nickel's worth or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, page 17, we have Doc's amok arms pulling down a chimney that throws bricks over the edge of the roof that Spidey and Doc are fighting on. Page 18, Spidey sees the bricks falling too late. He's still up on the roof and there's a little boy standing right under them. Captain Stacy jumps out of the crowd and pushes the kid to safety, but he ends up being completely hit by the bricks and Spidey sees it all go down.
And Captain Stacy is the only one who's running toward the kid. Everyone else is running away. He's literally the only person like who's running toward the danger.
Page 19, Spidey quickly gets to the ground and starts pulling debris off of Captain Stacy. And he hears a heartbeat, but it's weak. And Stacy tells him, I'm done for, son. Spidey picks him up and heads for a doctor in the next building. He sort of runs up the building with him. People on the street shout that, quote, it was Spider-Man's fault. He killed him. Mm. Page 20, Stacy tells Spidey that it's too late and he needs to put him down on a rooftop they've reached. Stacy says, I have to talk to you and there's so little time. It's Gwen. After I'm gone, there'll be no one to look after her. No one, Peter, except you. A few seconds later, Stacy dies. And we have Spider-Man, of course, realizing that Stacy knew who he was all along.
Yep.
We watched the grieving Spider-Man shaking as he holds the captain, lamenting the loss of Uncle Ben and now Stacy, two father figures that he couldn't save as he witnessed their deaths. Pete assures the now dead Stacy that I'll love Gwen and cherish her as long as I live, then says, but what if she ever learns that you died because of me?
Mm.
Yeah.
It's just huge.
Yeah. The staging of it is done really well. Like you're getting Captain Stacy's face and like you don't really see what's going on with Spider-Man. One, he's wearing the mask, so you can't really see. Mm-hmm. But on top of that, it's only like a corner of his eye for most of it. And then when he's most upset, you can't see his face at all. It's the back of his head.
Yeah.
And so you're just like projecting all this feeling onto it.
Yeah.
The second to the last panel of him holding Stacy's body and the lines showing him shaking.
Yeah.
That is what made me, that's what's making me right now go, don't cry. I gotta get through this.
It's also that, the coat, Peter Parker is like, when you picture Peter Parker, he's wearing that doofy yellow coat.
Mm-hmm.
And like the scene happens on a yellow ground. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, it kind of pulls you back into, cause he's wearing that coat a bunch in the issue. So it just like tethers it to him as a person in a really effective way.
Yeah.
So that is the death as advertised and the mega bummer as advertised.
Yeah.
He lost his other father figure.
And so the very last line, this is one thing I wanted to dig into where he says, you know, what if Gwen ever learns that you died because of me? So we definitely, you know, we overheard the bystanders saying that it was Spider-Man's fault. He killed him. But like,
he didn't.
He didn't. And does, I mean, would anyone in their right mind who knew the situation, and Peter knows he was there. He was there for the whole thing.
It's yeah, like, but
you didn't. It's like, would anyone, would any reasonable person say that Spider-Man killed Captain Stacy here?
Yeah, I don't think
that's
so.
Not, no. No, he would. Right?
It's just trying to throw back to like Betty Brant and and which it does well. I mean, mm-hmm. it's a sort of, if you ignore the fact that it's easily explained that Stacy is a hero, there was a superhero fight going on and he saved a kid.
Yeah.
It wasn't, I don't think everybody blames anyone who gets hit by shrapnel when Iron Man's shooting at something.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Regularly, but it's of course a thing that would happen in Spider-Man.
Yeah,
and like, but he also gets really bad press. So
he does, but I mean, I guess what I'm getting at is like, I mean, this is such an insight into Peter's psyche.
His,
you know,
anxieties,
it's like,
and
yeah,
the paranoia. Guilt is immediate. Yeah, immediate.
Immediate. Yeah. It's like he's like, oh no, I killed him. It's like, no, you didn't.
Yeah, you were not involved in this person's death at all. Really.
Yeah.
But the guilt instinct for him is immediate.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I can relate. I'm not Catholic, but I've got some stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, he, I mean, you can step back in his mind and see that he was fighting Doc Ock. He disabled some of Doc Ock's limbs. Those limbs knocked the bricks. Like, he was part of this. And then either there would be a dead boy or a dead Stacy.
Mm-hmm.
So I could see the rationale, especially in his
traumatized, deeply untherapied brain.
Deeply untherapied.
He's getting Uncle Ben'd again.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's such a rough note. And I did not expect it. I did not expect to care as much as I did by the time I got to the end of that issue.
Yeah. It's really well done.
And this is just the beginning of a real rough couple of years for poor Spidey.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. I think on that note, we got to take a break.
I got to get my, what's that called? My crying towel.
right. Have a seat on the fainting couch.
Yeah.
Okay, your crying towel.
All right. We'll be right back here on Marvel by the Month. All right, fellas. Once again, we have run right up against our recording time limit. Once again, we have failed to talk about most of the Marvel superhero comics that came out this month. You know what that means, boys. It is time to strap on our crash helmets, dive headfirst into the madness that is Marvel by the Minute.
It's Marvel by the Minute.
You know how this works. 60 seconds on the clock for each issue. Once the bell rings, it's time to move on to the next one. Rob, we're going to have you start out with Pawns of the Mandarin, the first story from Amazing Adventures number 3, written by Jack Kirby, art by Jack Kirby and Chick Stone. I think this is the last thing comes out with Kirby's name on it for quite some time. So,
at least it's 10 pages. It's a bunt,
10
right?
10 pages. 10 pages. You got this. Six seconds a page.
I screwed this up last time I got overconfident.
You cannot possibly
fail. Stay humble, my friend.
All right. 60 seconds on the clock. Go.
Okay. The Mandarin is watching the Inhumans through some cool gadgetry. They are investigating a site in which he is having people dig for something that's near them. Near the refuge, I guess. He flies out, messes with the Inhumans. They get in a big old fight. And then they seem to win, and get the take the Mandarin out. Then they decide they need to dig to find out what he was after. So they start. I think Black Bolt does some whatever electron scrambling, whatever he does. And
he invents a new power.
They dig a big hole and start going down there. And then we find out the Mandarin is fine. And that was like a Mandarin bot. And he wanted them to dig this hole for him. So he just tricked them into digging the hole. It's the whitewashing the fence kind
of. It's a real Van Lund.
Cornelius Van Lund.
And then they find some very weird statue, like a Shiva thing at the end.
Actually, nice. Yeah, that's pretty much all you need, right?
That's it.
Whew.
Terrific. we got this. This is going to be no problem.
As long as Jack Kirby wrote them all these issues and they're 10 pages long, you guys have no problem. Trust me.
Right. All right, Jamie. Next one up for you is The Widow and the Militants, which is the second issue, a second story from Amazing Adventures number 3, written by Gary Friedrich, art by Gene Colan, inked by Bill Everett. Really, really beautiful art, I thought.
Oh, yeah. It's gorgeous.
Yeah. So here's your 60 seconds. They're starting right now.
All right. We got a newspaper cover that shows the events of the last issue, which was Black Widow aligning herself with a group of kids against the bad guys. And then we get a whole newspaper scene with a whole lot of talking that doesn't really add up to much. Widow is out of there. She's going to go back to her fellas and see what's going on. She gets into her limo, but someone takes her captive. Then we cut to the kiddos, I guess they're young adults, who are very angry and they're fighting for their rights and they've got this whole building thing. And then we cut back to Widow and she's asleep, having been taken hostage by bad guys and one guy wearing a mask, a white sheet mask. She fights them, does a good job, beats them all up, including the guy with the mask, who says that she won, but then someone sneaks up behind her and whacks her. And then we cut to a newscaster who is saying that the public is now siding with the rule of law instead of the kids. But the Black Widow is still under gunpoint.
Oh, that wasn't bad.
Terrific.
Yeah, I feel like I might have left out like the important parts, but I covered the scope of the issue.
I think you're using pronouns well, though.
Yeah.
Like, they're doing something for a cause with the building. Like, just that kind of stuff. You're like,
right, right.
I don't have to say any names. Like, proper nouns are just going to throw you up.
Right, right.
Yeah. You didn't mention the part where she's changing in the back of her car and she tells her chauffeur not to look behind, which is a little racy
that
for a 1970 code-approved comic.
Absolutely, yeah. Like, maybe a little flirty.
Yeah.
There was also some, like, dialogue-free, like, the fight. There wasn't a... The words are oddly distributed in this issue. Like, some pages have all the words and then some pages have none.
Yeah. But yeah, the art is gorgeous enough that I don't.
Yeah, this is a great looking 10 pages.
It's like, give me some blank panels. Okay, I am going to tell you about Bucky Reborn, Captain America 131.
Oh gosh, good luck.
Written
oh,
by Stan Lee, art by Gene Colan and Dick Ayers. Bucky back from the dead? I don't buy it. Marvel would never do
They'd never do such a
thing. I'm putting 60 seconds on the clock, and here I go. So, remember that guy who we were talking about who was wearing the white hood in the last issue?
Yeah, we call him the Hood.
And some glasses that were like poking through holes in the side of the hood. He's in this one too. He is wandering around gyms checking out young men. Captain America getting crazy on his motorcycle. Hood Man finds a dude who looks just like Bucky Barnes, brings him somewhere.
Kid has amnesia.
Captain America hears that Bucky Barnes has been found and he survived World War II, goes to investigate. Turns out Hood Man is Baron Strucker, ex-Nazi master of weapons. Fight. Cap is distracted enough by Bucky, gets strapped to a giant clock. Bucky winds up coming to and saving Cap, and they defeat Baron Strucker.
Wow. Perfect. That
well
was
done.
That I think the judges give you a 5.0.
Oh, no, yeah.
Out of 5.
Out of 5.
Okay, thank you.
I'm not sure how judging works with sports parts.
No, that was great. Hey, so that part where he got tied to a giant clock, that was weird.
That was very Batman.
Yeah, it was super Batman.
Yep.
That's not a Marvel
comic. I held that up to Barb to look at. It was like, check out this weird Batman stuff going on here.
Yeah.
It was like magnets, too. He wasn't tied.
Yeah, and the way...
How do they work?
And the way it was going to kill him was there was like a little block where the midnight was. So as he's like turning, his head would, I guess,
gently bump it.
Like eventually just slowly press.
It's like, getting a real crick.
Yeah.
So he probably had longer than he thought. But anyway, we're back to Rob now. He's got to talk about a Jack Kirby-less issue of Fantastic Four, Our World Enslaved, written by Stan Lee, art by John Romita, inked by John Verporten.
Kind of a dense issue.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a lot going on in this one.
I will fail.
Okay. 1 minute. go for it.
Okay, Magneto has the Atlantean army. He has Sue and Dorma hostage. But so Fantastic Four and Namor are trying to figure out what to do. They decide that Namor needs to go say he's cool with working with Magneto and get undercover because they are invading New York. So, which they do. Nixon is not happy. Namor is sort of holding the line, trying to keep pretending he's working with Magneto. Then Torch and Namor work together to try to, I don't know what the hell they're doing now, and nor do I remember. But Sue gets loose and almost gets Magneto, but yeah. Magneto surrounds her with a bunch of nuts and bolts so he can see where this invisible person is. So she's recaptured. Then they're put in some really dumb tubes, Dorma and Sue. Oh, man, I'm not going to do this very well. There's also this whole thing. Okay, I got to say this, though.
Yeah, no.
This thing with Ben. They're in the Baxter Building. The Atlantean army is coming for them. They're coming up the elevator. Ben's idea, he's supposed to stall them while Reed works on the gizmo that's going to solve things.
Right, right.
To stall them, he rips open the elevator and pulls it up faster. Instead of like, you know, letting it go, like fall down.
Right.
Ben is not the thinker.
Nope.
So anyway, Reed makes a gizmo. He saves the day.
Yep. That's how it works.
Reed stretches and blasts in this issue. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that I've seen that before.
The old like, stretch and blast.
The old stretch and blast, which reminded me of an Infinity War.
Okay.
When he's at the podium. We'll get to it in 20 years.
Sure.
Crystal also shows up with a big distraction, too, to help them win. So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So everybody gets a
part. There was too much for that for a minute. Come on.
Yeah. No, there were a lot of characters also.
Okay, Jamie. Hopefully you can get us back on track here with Day of Thunder, Night of Death.
Yeah.
Incredible Hulk number 133, written by Roy Thomas, art by Herb Trimpe and John Severin.
Oh, so good.
I am starting your 60 seconds right now.
We open on a splash page. It's gorgeous. Hulk is cradling the body of his hurt friend, Jim. The army comes after Hulk to stop him, but General Ross walks up in person and like pleads and says, please let me help your buddy Jim or he's going to die. Hulk kind of is going along with it, but then some itchy trigger finger guy shoots the Hulk and then Hulk smash army and then runs away. He runs away and hides in a crate, leaving Jim behind. And that crate ships off to another country, which is led by a dictator. And there's also a little family there, and they're part of a rebellion against the dictator. Hulk and the dictator are fighting a whole bunch. And the family's also doing stuff in the background, but nothing that's really big. And then eventually the Hulk kind of shoves the dictator away, and he approaches the girl by the river with 6 seconds to spare.
Whoa. Wow. That's pretty good.
Yeah. I read this one 3 times. I kept falling asleep.
I love the art in this. I love that one page beautiful. Of no words. The one page of Hulk just sneaking around
Stealth Hulk
to get into a giant crate.
Stealth Hulk doesn't make any sense, but I love it.
Yeah. Also, like, no one noticed he was in that. They were like, this crate seems hulkier than usual. Yeah,
and he seems like, and he's able to just like be quiet.
Yeah.
And
right.
still.
I think he's really messed up by this gym situation.
He might be.
He just went to sleep. Hulk wake up in Morvania.
Right.
I have to say that watching a dictator get his just desserts with everything that's been going on in the news lately, this is
pretty nice.
Maybe a little extra satisfying.
There were nice. I read Barb the dictator's speech about being a peasant who couldn't even get a flag at a mead, but fate made me first a soldier in a tiny army, then its general, and finally in one fell swoop a nation's ruler.
Yeah.
But their country is nothing, and her borders can never be the borders of his ambition.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also his logo is the reverse flash.
Yeah.
Right.
With the sword through it.
Yeah.
Draxon.
Draxon, who looks like he is maybe 1 or 2 inches taller than Puck.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was another thing that
maybe it's just the giant hands and smooth head.
Yeah, and it's like a tall head. He's a very bald and has a very tall skull.
Yeah. Prominent skull.
But the pictures of the landscape in some of this are gorgeous.
Yeah,
the Herb Trimpe with Severin is gold.
Yeah,
it's terrific. They should be on that. They should still be on that book together, even though I don't believe either one of them is alive. Okay.
You're up.
Here I go. I'm going to tell you about Anything for the Cause from Iron Man number 31, written by Alan Brodsky, art by Don Heck and Chick Stone. Just going to let you know right now, I don't remember any of this. Here we go. There is a protest going on outside of Tony Stark's facilities. Oh, yeah, there's an island that this is happening on. A guy who looks like Veronica Lodge's father is pro Tony Stark. He is pro pollution. The people who are opposed to Tony Stark are threatening everyone with images of like mutations and things like that. So it's a very anti-GMO argument. Iron Man shows up and just punches the protesters because like, there's no First Amendment here, apparently. They lead some sort of, it's just, there's a protest and it.
There's bad protesters who have invaded the good protesters.
There's good protesters and bad protesters. And then there's like some militarized stuff with Iron Man fighting. You know what?
That was a mercy killing.
Yeah. This is a bad issue of Iron Man. It's just, and I'm not saying that just because I flubbed that so badly. That's completely on me. But just utterly, I don't know.
So there's a Tony Stark's setting up a nuclear power plant or something here on this island.
Yeah.
There are good protesters who are like, hey, don't mess up our land. And he's like, no, this is like the good kind of nuclear power plant that doesn't do that.
Right.
And then the good protesters are invaded by this like organization that's run by a bad guy.
Yeah.
Who's like,
The Smashers. Right.
Tony Stark has an Irish employee. And I think this is the first Irish person in a Marvel comic.
Maybe.
Yeah. I thought that was something. I don't know.
Don't got Dum Dum Duggan.
Is Banshee Irish or?
Oh, he's
Scottish.
He's so Irish.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I remember when he's introduced, right? There was some. I think he's Irish, but there was some ambiguity.
Thing, right?
Yeah.
When it
yeah.
started.
Okay. Oh, you're right. There was
in the very first issue. It was just sort of Roy vaguely.
Oh, really?
Like, yeah. It was
like somewhere.
It got fixed pretty fast.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of maiming an issue.
Yeah. You wanted to talk about Submariner?
I do, and I did not remember anything about the events, and I read it. I've read it maybe twice and
excellent.
I still don't remember the
all
events.
Right. Well, it's Atuma triumphant. So at least you know that Atuma shows up.
Atuma.
In it. Oh, and yeah. Nine other people.
Yeah.
There's too many people.
Oh, it's a Roy Thomas special. It's written by him. The art's by Sal Buscema and Joe Guadioso, AKA Mike Esposito. So, Rob, I'm going to start your 60 seconds right now.
Okay, we start off with Triton in the FF headquarters getting having some chats with Ben Grimm that are pretty hilarious. Then we get Namor, who finds out that, I don't even know what's happening. Something weird is going on with their chief scientist has been stolen from Atlantis.
Yes.
And then some barbaric Atlanteans try to take over a boat. And steal a bunch of hostages. Then it turns out that a stingray gets involved too. It turns out that Atuma is back and he has stolen Ixthon so that they can make a giant drill to like ruin Manhattan.
Yeah.
His plan is to like drill under the water and ruin Manhattan. So Stingray, Triton, and Namor team up and they stop Atuma. I mean, right? That sounds
wrong.
Pretty good. It's not wrong, so I'll take it.
There you go. Marvel gets all their underwater boys together.
Yeah, the peak of this issue was Namor, guy in a red costume, and Triton spinning around in a circle really fast.
Yes.
They whirlpool. You ever play a game in the pool?
Yep.
Yeah.
They whirlpool the bad guys into submission or something, and it forms like a rainbow.
Yep. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Rainbow of friendship. We got one comic left to do. Jamie, you got to get us out.
Oh,
of this.
Yeah, you can do. You're going to nail this.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
It's one. Why
did I butcher the last one of these?
Oh, no. Hey, we're all butchering things here.
The title of the story is One God Must Fall. You know that Rob didn't write that one because he would have said all. is Thor 181, written by Stan Lee, art is by Neil Adams and Joe Sinnott. I give it a shot, buddy. Here goes.
Okay, lore. Great start.
Oh, man.
Thor and Loki are still body swapped. Thor in Loki's body is in hell. Mephisto's causing problems. The Warriors 3 plus Sif are trying to fight Mephisto to get Thor back out of Loki's body. A lot of cool Mephisto monsters and things. And then Thor, meanwhile, is in the real world. Thor's body, occupied by Loki, starting trouble with the UN, as always. but Baldur is there to stop Thor, Loki in Thor's body. And then in Hellland, Mephisto just gets fed up and, like, sends them off, I believe.
I think Thor shows his soul.
Oh, no, Thor starts using Loki's magic.
Yes.
To fix everything. And then gets back to Asgard, and Odin's there. Oh man, that wasn't even close.
Oh, he gets a hold of Mjolnir. He gets
the way he solves this is that Thor in Loki's body, like, throws himself at Loki in Thor's body and, like, keeps fighting him, and Loki in Thor's body is like, you idiot, like, you can't match my strength. He's like, I don't have to match your strength. I just have to keep you busy for 60 seconds.
Rope-a-dope.
Oh, yeah. Right.
And then Loki in Thor's body turns back into lame Dr. Blake. Loki's spirit leaves that body, goes into Loki's body. Thor's spirit goes into lame Dr. Blake, grabs the thing, turns into Thor again, and body swaps.
I forgot, like, the 60-second thing, I thought we lost that in at some point. Or it just hasn't come up.
It just hasn't come up
for a year.
Yeah.
Something like
Kirby
that.
Got tired of doing it.
Yeah. And so, like, Thor, when he's in hell in Loki's body, uses Loki's magic to shrink himself. Shrink himself until he has no body at all and is pure soul.
Yeah, and that annoys Mephisto.
He
doesn't eat the glaring goodness of the soul. Yeah. It's much like the Silver Surfer. He just can't. It's just too, like, bright. Oh. It sucks. Yeah.
And Loki in Thor's body lifts a tank in an awesome splash page.
Yeah, that's pretty good. At. Yep. And then there's a really great panel at the very end of Thor telling Loki to yield. And Loki says, I do not fight. I do not yield. My hatred shall sustain me. And he's got a big old shiner. Yeah. So this is.
Oh, wait. One more thing in that one.
Yeah.
Start the timer.
they're in opposite bodies still. They're still body swapped, and they're having a fight in a junkyard or a construction site or something. And it reminded me of Superman when Superman fights bad Superman.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Felt familiar.
It's a great place for a fight.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is the second issue of Neil Adams and Joe Sinnott doing Thor. I think this is the last issue the two of them do. It was an experiment. Like, Adams wanted to try to do a Kirby riff, and I don't know if it was super successful. I mean, I would much rather just have Neil Adams
doing his Neil style.
Adams. Yeah.
So, anyway, it was at least it was, you know, a cool 2-issue stunt to help us forget that Jack Kirby is gone. He's never coming back.
And the story wasn't any worse than many of the. The latter era of Kirby phoning it in.
Yeah.
So,
and next issue we're promised Dr. Doom and Dr. Blake. So half of that's pretty cool.
And half of it's very not.
All right, fellas. Well, last thing we got to do here is make some recommendations for comics that we think our listeners might want to check out that are not the Marvel comics of August 1970. My recommendation this month is Milestone Compendium 1 by Dwayne McDuffie and a whole bunch of other people. So I don't know if you are really familiar with the Milestone Comics line, but it was published in the 90s, and it was so ahead of its time. It was a minority-owned comics line featuring diverse characters and a murderer's row of some of the best artists and writers in the business. It was all published as an imprint of DC Comics. It was not owned by DC, but it's distributed and published by DC. So it allowed them to piggyback on DC's distribution, and giving them an opportunity to compete in the marketplace that a, you know, specifically minority focused imprint probably would not have had under those circumstances. And they are just gloriously 90s superhero comics. Over the top, hyper everything, lots of group shots where everyone stands around and says their name and powers.
Yeah.
But there's also like a youthfulness and exuberance and just a finger on the pulseness that is so damn fun. This volume is a snapshot of Milestone's first year. It's like literally everything that came out that first year of Milestone. I wish I had some supplementary material to put on the context. I would still love to read the definitive history of Milestone Comics. And honestly, like, I kind of hate the 1300 page comics. Like, it's just they're too heavy.
Yeah.
I got dainty wrists. but these are super tiny nits to pick. They're fun comics. They're important comics. I'm really, really glad they're back in print.
Yeah. It's making me want to dig through the old boxes and look at Static, especially.
Static is so good. Like, it holds up so well. And also Zombie, which is one that I did not remember. But it is like as good as any of, I would say, like, it is like a mid-tier DC Vertigo comic. Yeah. It's like a Hellblazer.
It's got a good amount of weird. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of propping up behemoths of books, I recently finished the Black Hammer Library Edition Volume 2 by Jeff Lemire and Dean Ormston. The story, and I'm not going to reveal a bunch about it because there's a mystery at the heart of the story. But it was a bizarre mirror of Golden and Silver Age heroes. Okay. A lot of like really overt references to characters, especially like Kirby characters and New Gods but it goes full on cosmically Inception like bonkers for the second part. Cool. And it's so much fun. I really love Ormston's art. I was not super familiar and now I'm like, what else has he done? That's the coolest, but because of the dimensional shifts and weirdness that happens, we get to see totally different styles of art by Ormston. And then a couple other artists do little arcs and stories too. Huh. So, or parts of stories, Emmy Lennox and Rich Tommaso. And it's a satisfying read and just plain fun as the mystery unravels. It shows, even more breadth in Lemire's writing. His different styles between things like Gideon Falls, Sentient, Sweet Tooth, and lots more make me think of him as like the Doors of comic book writers. He's wide ranging, a little disturbing, but always engrossing and pushing a boundary even a little, you know, somewhere. So it's like he takes a trope and pushes it, or he does something totally new, but it's the styles seem like they could be totally disparate writers, but there's some thread that makes it make sense. Yeah.
That thread is sadness.
Yeah, that's true. That's the thing. It's like, even though I'm having such a good time, like there's a lot of like darkness in any of his stories.
He does sad Canadian darkness.
Yes.
Wow, that's a niche market.
It is. Yeah.
But it's great. No, I'm huge fan of Jeff Lemire.
Yeah. Can we should get him.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Hey, Jeff, give us a call. I'm sure you listen to us every week.
Yep.
With your spare time when you're not inventing entire universes.
All right, Jamie, what do you got to recommend?
All right. I know I'm skewing modern right now. That's just where I'm at. I know I'll someday get back and be obscure and smart and stuff. But for now, so this past weekend in 48 hours, I reread the entire X of Swords.
Sweet.
Crossover. It's great. It is a great story. It is great in the way that like Executioner's Song X-Men was great in that it's like as operatic as it gets. But you're also getting a lot of personal touches and the individual books don't really lose their flavor. A few of them like shift a bit, but like it's still all the people that you're there for that you like came to see. It's orchestrated incredibly deftly. I feel like all the writers get a chance to kind of shine in their own way. I feel like it's like a strength and limitations a little bit. Some, like, I know some creators like bristle under a crossover situation, but like something like this where like behind the scenes, they're all super aligned.
Yeah.
You feel it.
Mm-hmm.
And I read, I read these when they came out. I think I read them on as each one came out on Marvel Unlimited, but there was something about being able to like, to essentially stream through it that like made it come together in a way I hadn't really experienced. Also, now that we're significantly past that, you see a lot of story seeds that, I mean, I'm pretty adept at picking up at that stuff, but there was stuff that just flew right by me, and it's really cool to see where all these little bits have gone.
Yeah. Yeah. I've only read it the one time. I do think that it, I know there's a lot of folks who are just like, oh, I hate crossovers. Mm-hmm. You know, I think this is like about as well executed as a crossover gets. It's like, right? It's like, this is up there with like maybe Secret Invasion or something like that, you know,
yeah.
Where it's like, and it just goes to show, if you have a really flexible, but like organized editorial team, and they're making sure everyone's on the same page and everyone's having a chance to throw something into the pot and find something interesting.
yeah, it's like, it's not a crossover. It's just a thing that is happening through all of these books.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
It is this thing that's happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have only read a couple X of Swords books at all.
Oh, really?
So now I'm like, all right. Yeah. I'm in. Yeah.
And like, there's kind of a central misdirect.
Yes, I
thought
there is.
And it's brilliant.
It's really well executed.
Yeah, it just inverts. I mean, and that's what Jonathan Hickman does. There's symmetry and inversion, and this does those to a degree that is so clever.
Yeah.
Man, I'm down. The last crossover I read was like the something about Asgard, or you know, like,
oh,
there were
the
frost giants.
War of Realms.
Yeah. That whole thing. The only thing I liked about it was when you could see the books that were like, okay, we mentioned it, you know, just like a big middle finger. But it's hilarious. Like when Squirrel Girl was pulled into the, that was my favorite part of that. Yeah.
And of course, we're really happy that our friend Clint McElroy got to write a crossover for it.
Yes.
Actually, that was super fun. That, remember when he was, like, it was an editorial edict where, like, and they got approached to do this, you know, like months and months and months before, where they're like, okay, well, you know, you got to use Kate Bishop Hawkeye and you got to use Miles Morales. And they're like, Miles Morales, like, you know,
they were bummed because they wanted more of a D team.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
And then like Into the Spider-Verse comes out and they're like, oh, no, we're fine using Miles Morales. This is great.
Yeah. Turns out. So, surprise.
Yeah. So it didn't ruin the D team aspect of it too much by having the coolest hero in the Marvel Universe. Hey, that was another episode of Marvel by the Month. Congratulations. You made it through. We made it through.
Yeah, we did it.
It happened.
Yeah. Good work, everyone.
Yeah. We're just going to close this out here by reminding you that you can subscribe to our Patreon for the fantastic price of $4 a month at patreon.com/MarvelByTheMonth and get exclusive content. There's going to be more of that coming up this season.
Yeah.
So it is a value that only becomes more valuable over time. You can review us on Apple Podcasts or whatever you use to listen to us. If you'd like some free stuff in the mail, send us a screenshot of your 5-star review to marvelbythemonth@gmail.com. Find us on Instagram at marvelbythemonth and Twitter at marvelbtm. And please remember to check one or both of those to find out the details for our 150th episode live show extravaganza featuring Chelsea Kane, almost certainly on March 30th.
Quite possibly certainly.
That will have all the details. We'll pin that right to the top. Yeah, I mean, hopefully it's still happening by the time this comes out. Who knows? We may have just sunk into a giant crater by then.
Yeah.
MarvelByTheMonth.com has links to our other social channels as well as our shop. That is it for now. My name is Brian Stratton.
Mine is Rob Meld.
And I'm Jamie Wenger.
We'll see you next week for next month. Until then, stay safe, stay healthy, stay inside, and read comics.